All right, just past 4 o'clock here on this lovely Tuesday on the home stretch. Yesterday, we chose to focus our programming exclusively on the birthday of local legend Linda Ronstadt. So as such, Chris Carey was off yesterday, but he is back armed with a new classic pick from the B-52s. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, whoops, where are we? There we
go. There I am.
There okay. You are.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Yeah.
So we're looking at the B-52's debut, which came out 40 years ago this month. Yeah, I know. It's crazy that the B-52's debut was 40 years old.
40?
40? 1979.
Oh, I know that we do this a lot in the classic pick because it's, you know, the passage of time. But that's, yeah, that's striking to me.
Well, what's interesting to me is you know, for a good reason, I guess, is that, you know, that they totally get considered an 80s band, but they kind of started the 80s sound before the 80s.
Right, yes.
And they
Vanguards.
They actually formed in 1976. They all lived in Athens, Georgia, and they it started after an impromptu kind of jam session after a few drinks at a Chinese restaurant. And, of course,
One way to start a party.
Yeah, yeah. And then they did have a party. It was kind of a party band for a long time. And the original members were Cindy Wilson and her brother Ricky Wilson, who played lead guitar. She was, of course, a vocalist. Kate Pearson was vocalist and keyboards, Keith Strickland drums, and Fred Schneider voice and cowbell and other various things that he would play on stage. You know, they got together kind of impromptu-like and then kept playing out in Athens and started getting a lot of attention in Athens. And this is, you know, like probably late 76, 77. And a local guy by the name of Danny Beard, who had a record store and a small label in Athens called DB Records, he actually signed them. And all he really ever did was record the first version of Rock Lobster. And in 1978, that sold 20,000 copies of this little independent single. And they were touring a lot up and down the East Coast and started playing a lot, specifically in New York, and were favorites in CBGB's and Max's Kansas City, of course, famous new wave punk rock clubs in New York City, where a lot of other amazing 70s bands got their start. And with this success on this single, they attracted the attention of big national labels, and Warner Brothers signed them in 1978, signed them for North America, and Island Records signed them for the UK. And Island Records, at the time, that was the label that was started by Chris Blackwell. And Chris Blackwell is kind of, first of all, Island Records is one of the biggest independent labels of definitely of the 70s and 80s, but it was an incredible successful label that he started. So he started this record, he signed them in the UK, and he also was the guy who ended up producing their first album, too, and he took them down to Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas, which is the studios that he's founded.
That's right. We've talked about a few different albums that recorded there.
Yeah, Chris Blackwell, and almost all of these were done by him. This guy was, he was a genius in just finding talent. I mean, he, you know, started and helped develop the careers of, like, U2 and the top, and some of Dire Straits' later stuff, Bob Marley, ELO, Eric Clapton. He worked with all these people, and like Talking Heads' Remain in Light was recorded there. Tom Tom Club's debut was recorded there. AC/DC's Back in Black was recorded there. So it's all of these different kinds of albums were recorded in the Bahamas. And I mean, I guess it's not hard to get a band to
yeah,
go there.
Twist my rubber arm and go.
Yeah, and
to
I'm
the
sure that the what they owed the label back was more than an average studio too, though. anyway, so he went down there and he recorded them, and to the band's surprise, he didn't do much in the studio as far as effects or anything else, and they kind of thought that he would, but he loved their live sound so much that he wanted to do his best to record and their actual live kind of sound to get on the record. And so, I mean, actually, I was watching some really early footage of them, and they really do. I mean, they do kind of, they sounded as good as they do on this record live. I mean, they were pretty cool for the fact that actually, you know, three of them in the band really didn't have any instrument backgrounds.
Right.
Of course, you know, Ricky Wilson's guitar playing, I think, is amazing. It's really, really, really cool. And, I mean, it's pretty distinctive at the time, kind of angular. And you can hear in what they do how it, even though it was kind of this good time fun kind of band, and it was a pastiche of things that they threw together, that, you know, like 60s soul, 70s funk, both punk and early post-punk, that at that time was, you know, all both of those were kind of still in their early years, as well as they borrowed a lot from us, you know, B science fiction movies, and it was pretty great, and at the time really novel. In fact, you know, most of the new wave bands at the time were either, you know, most new wave bands kind of had that kind of cool kind of attitude, and then, you know, on the flip side, you'd have the punk bands, which were getting more and more kind of vulgar. You know, you had the Sex Pistols and some other bands like that that people didn't know how to take. And so you had this band here that was kind of had this prestige and were more fun and more about dancing. And it was kind of, it kind of really took a lot of people off guard. And they did sound a lot different at the time. Now, they don't sound as different now, but it's because I think
they were influential.
They influenced a lot of stuff. I mean, I kind of think there wouldn't, I mean, the whole Riot Girl movement is, you know, a lot of it is based on what the B-52s kind of started sound-wise. I mean, I can't imagine a Tigra or a Sleater-Kinney without B-52s coming before them.
That is a fair assessment.
So yeah, I mean, they're kind of, even though they kind of came, you know, just kind of cultural pop kind of icons in a fun kind of way, I mean, from a serious standpoint, musically, they really did affect a lot of what went on in the 80s and 90s and past then. And I know that, you know, a lot of people, and a lot of serious musicians love them. I know that John Lennon was actually quoted in a magazine in 1979 saying this was one of his favorite albums of the year.
Really?
Yeah, John Lennon.
Now, see, that I guess that makes sense, but it's just not something I would guess off the top of my head. That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was pretty cool, too. And I mean, there was a lot of relief. I know that Kurt Cobain, too, he's commented on how much he loved this album. And so it really is, and in my opinion, now that there's two other really good. They didn't have that many albums. They had about six, I believe. I'd have to go back and count them. But their first two were really good. And Cosmic Thing, I think, is pretty good. It Cosmic Thing definitely sold more than anything else. It sold 4 million copies. But this album actually, though, did eventually go in platinum. It sold over 1 million copies in the U.S. and it charted fairly high. It charted decently on the Billboard charts and the U.K. charts. But yeah, I mean, this was one of the bands that kind of started the whole college rock scene of the 1980s and early 90s.
I'm talking with Chris Carey about the B-52s, a self-titled release, came out right around this time back in 1979, making it 40 years old. It is our classic pick of the week. Other things to add before we get into your selection, Chris?
Not too much, other than this track three, which is Dance This Mess Around, is one of my favorite songs on the album, and I really, really like just the kind of back and forth in vocals and the guitar playing in this one. It's pretty good.
Yeah, good times with the B-52s, our classic pick of the week. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.